Chapter 2. What we can, we must do our endeavor and care nothing at all, when the unthinking reproach us for not turning out goblins. Why? And so we are mere machines. And machines may not boast, nor feel proud of their performance, nor claim personal merit for it, nor applause and praise. It is an infamous doctrine. It isn't a doctrine, it is merely a fact. Why? I suppose, then, there is no more merit in being brave than in being a coward? Personal merit? No. A brave man does not create his bravery. He is entitled to no personal credit for possessing it. It is born to him. A baby born with $1 billion, where is the personal merit in that? A baby born with nothing, where is the personal demerit in that? The one is fawned upon, admired, worshipped, by sycophants, the other is neglected and despised, where is the sense in it? Why? Sometimes a timid man sets himself the task of conquering his cowardice and becoming brave and succeeds. What do you say to that? That it shows the value of training in right directions over training in wrong ones. Inestimably valuable is training, influence, education, in right directions, training one's self-approbation to elevate its ideals. Why? But as to merit, the personal merit of the victorious coward's project and achievement? There isn't any. In the world's view, he is a worthier man than he was before, but he didn't achieve the change. The merit of it is not his. Why? Whose, then? His make, and the influences which wrought upon it from the outside. Why? His make? To start with, he was not utterly and completely a coward, or the influences would have had nothing to work upon. He was not afraid of a cow, though perhaps of a bull. Not afraid of a woman, but afraid of a man. There was something to build upon. There was a seed. No seed, no plant. Did he make that seed himself, or was it born in him? It was no merit of his that the seed was there. Why? Anyway, the idea of cultivating it, the resolution to cultivate it, was meritorious, and he originated that. He did nothing of the kind. It came whence all impulses, good or bad, come from outside. If that timid man had lived all his life in a community of human rabbits, had never read of brave deeds, had never heard speak of them, had never heard anyone praise them, nor express envy of the heroes that had done them, he would have had no more idea of bravery than Adam had of modesty, and it could never by any possibility have occurred to him to resolve to become brave. He could not originate the idea, it had to come to him from the outside. And so, when he heard bravery extolled and cowardice derided, it woke him up. He was ashamed. Perhaps his sweetheart turned up her nose and said, "I am told that you are a coward." It was not he that turned over the new leaf, she did it for him. He must not strut around in the merit of it, it is not his. Why? But, anyway, he reared the plant after she watered the seed. No. Outside influences reared it. At the command, untrembling, he marched out into the field with other soldiers and in the daytime, not alone and in the dark. He had the influence of example, he drew courage from his comrades' courage. He was afraid, and wanted to run, but he did not dare. He was afraid to run, with all those soldiers looking on. He was progressing, you see, the moral fear of shame had risen superior to the physical fear of harm. By the end of the campaign, experience will have taught him that not all who go into battle get hurt, and outside influence which will be helpful to him, and he will also have learned how sweet it is to be praised for courage, and be huzzaed at with tear-choked voices as the war-worn regiment marches past the worshipping multitude with flags flying and the drums beating. After that he will be as securely brave as any veteran in the army, and there will not be a shade, nor suggestion of personal merit in it anywhere. It will all have come from the outside. the Victoria Cross breeds more heroes than Y. Hang it, where is the sense in his becoming brave, if he is to get no credit for it? Your question will answer itself presently. It involves an important detail of man's make which we have not yet touched upon. Why? What detail is that? The impulse which moves a person to do things, the only impulse that ever moves a person to do a thing. Why? The only one. Is there but one? That is all. There is only one. Why? Well, certainly that is a strange enough doctrine. What is the sole impulse that ever moves a person to do a thing? The impulse to content his own spirit, the necessity of contenting his own spirit and winning its approval. Why? Come, that won't do. Why won't it? Why? Because it puts him in the attitude of always looking out for his own comfort and advantage, whereas an unselfish man often does a thing solely for another person's good, when it is a positive disadvantage to himself. It is a mistake. The act must do him good, first, otherwise he will not do it. He may think he is doing it solely for the other person's sake, but it is not so. He is contenting his own spirit first, the other person's benefit has to always take second place. Why? What a fantastic idea! What becomes of self-sacrifice? Please answer me that. What is self-sacrifice? Why? The doing good to another person, where no shadow nor suggestion of benefit to oneself can result from it. 2. Man's sole impulse, the securing of his own approval, old man. There have been instances of it, you think? Young man. Instances? Millions of them. You have not jumped to conclusions? You have examined them critically? Why? They don't need it. The acts themselves reveal the golden impulse back of them. For instance? Why? Well then, for instance. Take the case in the book here. The man lives 3 miles uptown. It is bitter cold, snowing hard, midnight. He is about to enter the horse car, when a gray and ragged old woman, a touching picture of misery, puts out her lean hand, and begs for rescue from hunger and death. The man finds that he has a quarter in his pocket, but he does not hesitate. He gives it her, and trudges home through the storm. There it is noble, it is beautiful, its grace is marred by no fleck, or blemish or suggestion of self-interest. What makes you think that? Why? Pray what else could I think? Do you imagine that there is some other way of looking at it? Can you put yourself in the man's place, and tell me what he felt, and what he thought? Why? Easily. The sight of that suffering old face pierced his generous heart with a sharp pain. He could not bear it. He could endure the 3 mile walk in the storm, but he could not endure the tortures his conscience would suffer if he turned his back and left that poor old creature to perish. He would not have been able to sleep for thinking of it. What was his state of mind on his way home? Why? It was a state of joy which only the self-sacrificer knows. His heart sang, he was unconscious of the storm. He felt well? Why? One cannot doubt it. Very well. Now let us add up the details, and see how much he got for his 25 cents. Let us try to find out the real why of his making the investment. In the first place, he couldn't bear the pain which the old suffering face gave him. So he was thinking of his pain, this good man. He must buy a salve for it. If he did not succor the old woman, his conscience would torture him all the way home. Thinking of his pain again. He must buy relief for that. If he didn't relieve the old woman, he would not get any sleep. He must buy some sleep still thinking of himself, you see. Thus, to sum up, He bought himself free of a sharp pain in his heart. He bought himself free of the tortures of a waiting conscience. He bought a whole night's sleep all for 25 cents. It should make Wall Street ashamed of itself. On his way home, his heart was joyful, and it sang profit on top of profit. The impulse which moved the man to succor the old woman was first to content his own spirit, secondly to relieve her sufferings. Is it your opinion that men's acts proceed from one central and unchanging and inalterable impulse, or from a variety of impulses? Why? From a variety, of course, some high and fine and noble, others not. What is your opinion? Then there is but one law, one source. Why? That both the noblest impulses and the basest proceed from that one source? Yes. Why? Will you put that law into words? Yes. This is the law, keep it in your mind. From his cradle to his grave, a man never does a single thing which has any first and foremost object, but one, to secure peace of mind, spiritual comfort, for himself. Why? Come. He never does anything for anyone else's comfort, spiritual, or physical. No. Except on those distinct terms that it shall first secure his own spiritual comfort. Otherwise he will not do it. Why? It will be easy to expose the falsity of that proposition. For instance? Why? Take that noble passion, love of country, patriotism. A man who loves peace and dreads pain, leaves his pleasant home and his weeping family and marches out to manfully expose himself to hunger, cold, wounds, and death. Is that seeking spiritual comfort? He loves peace and dreads pain? Why? Yes. Then perhaps there is something that he loves more than he loves peace, the approval of his neighbors and the public. And perhaps there is something which he dreads more than he dreads pain, the disapproval of his neighbors and the public. If he is sensitive to shame, he will go to the field not because his spirit will be entirely comfortable there, but because it will be more comfortable there than it would be if he remained at home. He will always do the thing which will bring him the most mental comfort, for that is the sole law of his life. He leaves the weeping family behind. He is sorry to make them uncomfortable, but not sorry enough to sacrifice his own comfort to secure theirs. Why? Do you really believe that mere public opinion could force a timid and peaceful man to, go to war? Yes, public opinion can force some men to do anything. Why? Anything? Yes, anything. Why? I don't believe that. Can it force a right principled man to do a wrong thing? Yes. Why? Can it force a kind man to do a cruel thing? Yes. Why? Give an instance. Alexander Hamilton was a conspicuously high-principled man. He regarded dueling as wrong, and as opposed to the teachings of religion, but in deference to public opinion he fought a duel. He deeply loved his family, but to buy public approval he treacherously deserted them, and threw his life away, ungenerously leaving them to lifelong sorrow in order that he might stand well with a foolish world. In the then condition of the public standards of honor, he could not have been comfortable with the stigma upon him of having refused to fight. The teachings of religion, his devotion to his family, his kindness of heart, his high principles, all went for nothing when they stood in the way of his spiritual comfort. A man will do anything, no matter what it is, to secure his spiritual comfort, and he can neither be forced nor persuaded to any act which has not that goal for its object. Hamilton's act was compelled by the inborn necessity of contenting his own spirit. In this it was like all the other acts of his life, and like all the acts of all. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.